Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are neglecting, alas, as we have in this country more or less for decades, one of the most important battle spaces in that war for the free world. It is being waged vociferously at the moment by our enemies in what some call our backyard. I think of it as our front yard. It is Latin America. And a man who is deeply engaged, as he has been, in the fight for freedom in his native Peru and indeed throughout our hemisphere is our first guest. He is the Honorable Francisco Tudela, a man with a distinguished record of service in Peru and on the international stage. He is a former first vice president of that country, also formerly its foreign minister, its UN ambassador, a member of its Congress, and more. We are delighted to catch up with him to talk about a webinar in which he participated, co-sponsored by the Center for Security Policy and the Center for a Secure Free Society, that occurred yesterday. And he spoke very powerfully in its course, and we're delighted to have him with us to reprise a bit of what was said yesterday and what we all ought to be thinking about, not just about what's going on in Peru, which was subjected to a fraudulent election last summer that resulted in the coming to power of a communist, but what that means for the region, and particularly for several countries, including Chile, which is having elections on Sunday that could either reverse, perhaps slow, or accelerate the trend towards a communist takeover of much, if not all, of our hemisphere. Mr. Vice President, it is a privilege to have you with us once again. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir.
Good morning, Frank. I'm delighted to have this interview with you. And what you say is absolutely true. There is a battlefield in Latin America in which the neo-Marxist humanist atheistic left is confronting what we could call the liberal conservatives and conservatives and right-wing people that believe in the republican system, in the constitutional state, in the rule of law,
and in freedom, in short.
Of course, freedom is the essence of constitutional rule, and they don't want to be under a totalitarian socialist government, as is happening in Venezuela or in Nicaragua or in Cuba. What happened in my country was a prosperous country with, of course, a complex history. But we were very effective reducing poverty and having a stable growth of around 6% per year. This went well until the year 2016, in which the Odebrecht scandals broke out, and there was a loss of prestige of the whole political class. On top of that, you had several scandals of corruption additional to the one of Odebrecht that was huge, and the COVID-19 epidemic. And during the last 20 years after the fall of President Fujimori, that was caught in a corruption scheme in which his intelligence chief was paying people of the opposition and media owners, he fled the country, and the pre-1990 parties with the left with what you call the Champagne left and the far left, got into power, made a tacit alliance.
Mr. Vice President, I'm afraid we're going to run out of time before we finish the complex history of which you speak. Let me just ask you about the present moment. We have now communists in power in Lima, increasingly, I guess, across the country as well. Talk a little bit about the subject of a paper, a forthcoming paper that we'll be publishing at the Center for Security Policy, namely the threat that that government represents not just to freedom, as you say, in your own country, but to the region more generally, the hemisphere.
Well, all the region is connected because since 20 years ago and establishment of the Foro de Sao Paulo, that is a kind of fifth international, communist fifth international, all the communist governments interact between them and all the communist parties of the continent interact between them. Yesterday there was a showdown because since June that the communist government was elected, there were some successes of the government in consolidating their power. But finally, after several scandals, the Congress tried to vacate the president. That failed. Yesterday, the government party tried to censor the president of Congress. They failed, and Congress was able to pass a law by which no referendum for a new constitution can be made unless Congress approves it. And no legislative faculties have been given to the government for the new taxation policy. So it's a big defeat of this communist government. And the president has asked for help of the Mexican President López Obrador, who yesterday held a press conference of support for Pedro Castillo. What's the essence of what I am describing? All communist parties in Latin America are connected. And they are connected. They are a kind of second circle. The first circle are the National Communist Party. They are full members of this Forum of Sao Paulo. And the Forum of Sao Paulo, at the same time, has patrons. And those patrons are China, Russia, Iran, in a more discreet way. And they have been penetrating the whole continent and Peru. And Peru, with the communist government, shifted its foreign policy from the West to Russia and China and allies of Iran in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Asia,
and some of their proxies, like of course Cuba and Bolivia. And
that's right. Because Cuba, in fact, It's a leader of the Sao Paulo Forum. That is this fifth international that groups around 124 communist parties of South America. So
we're speaking with Vice President Francisco Tudela, formerly the second ranking individual in his government in Peru. And I just want to say, sir, if you would tie this set of developments into what it means for the United States, not just the region, but for us here in the United States, if Peru goes down this road, we're heartened by this defeat that you've just described, but the overall trajectory is very ominous, is it not? In what ways, specifically, for people in this country?
Well, I think the first thing is that Peru will become a Chinese protectorate and a mega buyer of Russian weapons. And the Chinese are developing a huge port 80 kilometers to the north of Lima in Chiangcai. It's a commercial port, but it's the first port they built in Latin America. And so that means, inside the geopolitics of the South Pacific and the Indo-Pacific, that Peru, that is in the western coast of Latin America, will be a center of projection for China into the continent, a hub, as President Xi Jinping has expressed, Peru will be the hub of the Belt and Road Initiative in Latin America. And at
the
same time,
a colonial build out of infrastructure and power projection
to the People's Liberation Army Navy in the future. And that new strategic position in the Western coast, of course, is in the rear guard of the U.S. policy in the North Pacific vis-a-vis China. So, in fact, it debilitates the strategy of the Pirate of Asia. At the same time, there is a cocaine connection. So these are parties, communist parties, linked to drug production, to cocaine, to coca fields. That's the case in Colombia, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Peru. So if they are able in Peru to win, they will expel DEA, they will expel the USAID, and you will have a narco state like is the case of Bolivia. So
huge new infusions of drugs into this country, needless to say.
Is that we are fighting not for Peru, we are fighting for the continent. And the same thing is happening in Chile on Sunday. Now the percentage of CAST, a Christian conservative candidate, and Boric or Boric, depending on how you pronounce it, the neo-Marxist, atheistic, humanist candidate of the communists, have each 48% of intention of vote. So it's a very close run, the one we have on Sun. But Chile falls, then the whole western coast of Latin America have fallen, and that is very dangerous.
Very dangerous
but
indeed.
We must
not least, Mr. Vice President, one last point, and we have to let you go, I'm afraid, but you've also spoken very powerfully about the cumulative effects that the communist agenda can have, will have, one might more accurately say, in these countries when they take down their economic viability and they create oppression, inevitably large numbers of people flee. And that will intensify, almost certainly, the immigration flows into this country. Mr. Vice President, we have to leave it at that. I want to commend you and the other participants in the terrific webinar that we did on the hostile forces that are operating in our hemisphere now, that are many of them external to it, but are nonetheless penetrating it, subverting it, weaponizing it, really, against freedom-loving people here and elsewhere. I thank you for your leadership in Peru at this very important moment, and obviously your warnings about Chile, I hope, will be heard as well by the people of Chile. We would love to catch up with you after the election to take stock on where we find ourselves, where the region is headed. But in the meantime, let me just say thank you for your great public service to your country and championing the cause of freedom for all of us. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Colonel Grant Newsom. We'll talk a bit more about what China's up to here and elsewhere right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say all welcome to Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, man who not only served his country with distinction in the uniform of the Marines, but also as a foreign service officer. He's also been very active in business affairs in East Asia, and he has, in recent years, been a research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, focusing, of course, on Asia-Pacific defense, political, and economic matters. Very proud to say he is also a senior fellow with our Center for Security Policy. Ever a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Colonel, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
You had a piece that caught my eye in Asia Times recently entitled Defending Taiwan, Think Globally and Look Up. It's a very interesting piece about how to, Dwight Eisenhower said, paraphrasing here, something like, when a problem is big, make it bigger to solve it. Talk a little bit about your sort of recommendation on a strategy for trying to, well, in the first instance, defer the Chinese from their evident intent to attack Taiwan, and if that fails, to defeat them.
Well, yes, the point of the article is that most of the discussion on a scenario or war involving Taiwan, it focuses on Taiwan itself, the Taiwan Strait, and the area immediately around it, as if the fight is going to be restricted to that specific geographical location. If that happens, America is at a great disadvantage, and it's reported that the Americans lose all the war games that we do about such a scenario. So what I suggest is that we should look at the entire globe and, if necessary, attack on a broader front. And why I say that is China depends on its overseas assets and resources for food and oil and finance its money. And these are very vulnerable. Their supply lines are open, and the Chinese military, as much as it has advanced in the last 20 years, it cannot defend its supply lines. And that's where it's extremely vulnerable. So what I argue is that rather than just focusing on this very, very difficult problem of how to win a narrow fight in the Taiwan Straits, that you look at the whole world and give China a choice. You know, if they go after Taiwan, they lose all their food, they lose their energy. Make it clear that that's what they will face. And that gives us a huge advantage if we, say, look at the whole map and build our strategy along those lines. Additionally, China is very vulnerable to financial sanctions. As I've mentioned before, that the Chinese currency is not convertible, which means that it's very hard to use overseas because not many people want it. So cut them off from the U.S. dollar network on which they depend, and they've got another serious problem. So if you expand the battlefield, as Eisenhower, I guess, said, make it bigger, China has some very serious disadvantages, and we have some very real advantages. And that's, I think, where we ought to be looking now.
Let me just put to you a question that I don't mean as rhetorical. I think it's very relevant and probably obvious. I'm pretty sure the Chinese are thinking globally about all of this as well. There's a lot of reason to believe that they have in mind invading India, perhaps concurrently, though as a military man, you would know, generally speaking, two-front wars are ill-advised. They may have in mind making it a bigger problem for us as well. And between that general sort of strategic idea and their strategic partnership with the Russians and effectively with the Iranians and certainly with the North Koreans, there's a lot of other mischief makers who could be brought up on the net, either by prearrangement or perhaps just by opportunism on the part of Vladimir Putin, the mullahs in Iran, and Kim Jong-un in North Korea. So, Colonel, when you talk about this strategy for making the problem bigger or deterring the Chinese, hopefully, have you anticipated that they may be planning on doing very much the same thing, and how prepared are we to contend with that? And would it affect their deterrence calculations that we are not, perhaps?
Yes, well, the Chinese look at the whole map as well, and they understand their own vulnerabilities. But as part of that, they also understand how we can be distracted and diverted so that we can't focus just on, say, a Taiwan scenario. And as you mentioned, what I would expect is in the event of the Chinese doing something towards Taiwan, I would expect Russia to make a move of some sort, you know, at least enough to force the Americans to keep their attention focused on, say, Europe. Similarly, at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if the North Koreans made a move that, once again, forces us to keep attention and effort and resources focused on the Korean Peninsula. The Indian border, same thing. And Iran as well. If they make any sort of move in the Middle East, well, America has to look after that. So what you can do is you can prevent the Americans with 3, 4, 5 other serious problems that they have to be ready to deal with, and they cannot focus all their resources on Taiwan. And to say the Chinese know that, and I expect them to do that.
Well, again, I guess I'm trying to perform a little bit of a net assessment here as to whether they're better prepared to act globally, especially if you throw into the mix, in addition to the points you've very usefully made, Colonel, the prospect that some, if not a number, of the places that they have effectively colonized in their Belt and Road Initiative. We were just talking with Francisco Tudela about Latin America, for example, or Africa, or Southeast Asia, or South Asia, for that matter, perhaps even Europe. become places where we are also going to be pulled, distracted, or otherwise disorganized. When you put all that together, I'm concerned that net-net, they may feel advantaged and thereby emboldened to act in Taiwan and, again, perhaps elsewhere. Your thoughts?
Well, that could happen. And the so-called Belt and Road Initiative and all of these overseas commercial presence that the Chinese have, that is intended eventually to have a military purpose. So you will, over time, and it could be a decade, say, you'll have a very substantial overseas Chinese military presence. Additionally, it will have a bigger Chinese military that is more capable of projecting power, of protecting its supply lines. And that's where they're headed. It may take them a while to get there. But also, when they have this commercial presence around the world, that this leads to political influence. So these countries shift more towards China, away from the United States, and that further strengthens China's overseas position. So they're looking for a global presence, so just like we have. They understand how useful it is for us. They understand how vulnerable they are with without it. And that's what they're trying to do. As I say, it may take them a while, but they are setting out on a strategy that is intended to sort of keep us sort of on the back foot and eventually to dominate us and give us no good options other than to give up. And that's what they're headed for. And you know, one does hope that the Americans have a coherent, systematic strategy for dealing with this. A lot of what we do is ad hoc. It doesn't seem particularly well thought out as a part of a comprehensive long-term plan. The Chinese have think a little more clearly than us in this regard.
They think a lot more strategically, I think, and certainly over a longer period of time, game out these moves, an advantage of being students and practitioners of Go, when at best we may be practitioners of chess and more likely checkers, or tiddlywinks perhaps. What we are talking about, sir, if I may, is further complicated by something that you suggested might be a response by us to their predations, again, whether it's in Taiwan or India or elsewhere. And for that matter, that we've also threatened would be a response to Russia, their strategic partner, should it actually invade Ukraine, namely to cut them off from the banking system. There was a, as you know, publicized video call between the president of Russia and the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, earlier this week, in which, among other things, they affirmed their strategic relationship, and they said specifically they were going to redouble their efforts to take the dollar down as the reserve currency of the world, something that would almost certainly be further impelled by, again, these kinds of threats to their access to the international banking system. What's your response to that prospect? It hasn't happened so far. They've been talking about it for a while. But do you think that we're at the cusp of perhaps a much more concerted effort and possibly a more successful one in this regard with the dollar?
Well, we may not be at the cusp, but we're pretty close to it. And this is a real serious threat. And if we lose the dollar dominance, if the U.S. dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, we are in huge, huge trouble. And even beyond the China's military buildup. I don't know that we could survive it. That's how important it is. And I'm not sure on the U.S. side that U.S. Treasury officials and financial officials understand this. And that's how serious this is. The Russians and the Chinese understand this, and that is what they are hell-bent on trying to do, is to displace the dollar.
And it sounds as though, at least some of our experts like Kyle Bass, a fellow member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, as you are, Grant Newsom, that the Chinese may actually finally have come up with a digital currency or cryptocurrency, as the case may be, that could somehow be attractive enough to the international community to make it a new reserve currency. We'll see, but it is very worrying. I grant you that, sir. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for all that you have done for our country and continue to do in Japan and with our Committee on the Present Danger of China and Center for Security Policy. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon about all of these really important issues. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Winston Churchill described the run-up to World War II as the gathering storm. Today's geostrategic atmospheric conditions suggest that another global conflagration is in the offing in our time. Consider the following indicators of heavy weather inbound. Communist China is building up its forces for attacks on Taiwan and or India. Russia has massed 100,000 troops on its border with Ukraine. Iran's nuclear weapons program could bear fruit at any time, resulting in a devastating attack on or by Israel. North Korea has most of its million-man army poised to invade South Korea. Each of these enemies of freedom actively talk about their intention to exercise these options, and if any of them do so, chances are good that one or more of the others, whether by prearrangement or sheer opportunism, will pile on. Forewarned, better be forearmed. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
A contemporary of Mozart and Haydn, he started losing his hearing at age 28 and eventually became totally deaf. Incredibly, though, he continued writing some of the most beautiful symphonies, concertos, sonatas, and quartets of all time. Today, he ranks as one of the greatest composers in history. His name was Ludwig van Beethoven, and he was born this day, December 17, 1770. Beethoven wrote, "No friend have I must live by myself alone. But I know well that God is nearer to me than others in my art, so I will walk fearlessly with Him."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a colleague and friend and inspiration, mentor, leader of many years. His name is Roger Robinson. We served together in the Reagan administration. He, much more significantly than I, as the right-hand man for President Reagan's strategy for taking down the Soviet Union, when he served as the Senior Director for International Economic Affairs on the Reagan National Security Council under the great Judge William P. Clark. Roger has a background in banking at Chase Manhattan Bank as, among other things, a special assistant to its chairman, David Rockefeller. He has been a figure of great importance, I think, in the public policy arena with his company RWR, advisory with his think tank in Prague, the Prague Security Studies Institute, and not least as the chairman of the U.S.-China Commission on Economic and Security Affairs. It's great to have you with us, Roger. I know you're speaking at the moment in your capacity as chairman of the Prague Security Studies Institute, but we're delighted always to have you with us to talk about China.
Well, it's delightful to be here.
Thank you. I wanted particularly to update our audience on some developments this week by the Biden-Harris administration with respect to something that you've been warning is a problem for many, many years, namely that we are underwriting the mortal enemy of this country, this Chinese Communist Party. You participated very handsomely in a webinar that the Committee on the Present Danger China did recently. People can check out that video at Present Danger China, and I urge them to do so. But tell us whether the Biden team is getting religion, Roger, on this point that we mustn't continue to finance the myriad forms of unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party is waging against us.
Well, Frank, it's a bit of a mixed story. As you know, going back to the previous administration, this was the first time that capital market sanctions had ever been instituted in our foreign policy toolkit, so to speak. And that was, of course, terribly important because I believe this is the most potent and effective non-military policy tool in our country's arsenal. The Chinese care about the money, in short. They can live with trade problems, currency manipulation accusations, technology security measures against them. They have found workarounds, and they know they can live with that. But the money is another matter, and it's hundreds of billions a year they need to take out of the U.S. investor community, basically to keep it together over there and to keep that growth rate at a sustainable level for the Communist Party to remain in power. So this is not a trivial concern for them. They don't have a convertible currency. They're frantic about our world leadership with the dollar as the reserve currency, not to mention the fact that our capital markets are the size of the rest of the world's combined, and the U.S. possesses about 66% of the world's liquidity. I mean, this is really one of the last great domains that we utterly dominate on this planet, and it's one that's vital to them that we are holding the cards on for a change. So, I would just say that it was a big, momentous event for Executive Order 13959 when we went after Chinese military companies as a nation for the first time and basically said that retail investors in the United States, scores of millions of them, shouldn't be underwriting advanced weapon systems to be used against our men and women in uniform, and indeed right down to ICBMs targeting our cities, both land-based and sea-based. So the Biden administration, I don't mean to make this long-winded, but the Biden administration did continue to preserve cap market sanctions. They did have their own executive order that mirrored more or less, and I think less than more, the Trump administration's EO. But then this was all on June 3rd. There was reason to be pleased and to give them a nod of approval there. The only problem is that there wasn't, yes, indeed, and there wasn't one company added since June 3rd of this year. So it's terribly important to notice these things because it gets to the issue of resolve. Are you just trying to play hard on, you know, tough on China for political reasons, but really don't have your heart in it in terms of tinkering with those Wall Street fees? Or do you actually care about protecting American retail investors, our national security, or our fundamental values? So those are the questions on the table still, Frank.
I understand. And they did add a few companies of Chinese origin and tied very closely, as all Chinese companies are, of course, to the Chinese Communist Party, to, I guess, both the entities list and the so-called Chinese military corporations list. But give us a sense of the magnitude of problem we've got in terms of these companies' presence in our capital markets, Roger, versus the numbers that have been designated as problematic or sanctioned by first Trump and now, to a smaller extent, Biden.
Well, that is quite a scandalous story, frankly. I mean, the fact that the administration and even the media has picked up on the fact that there's some 270 Chinese companies listed in the United States, well, that may be true vis-a-vis NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, but what about the 900 Chinese companies in the very under-regulated over-the-counter market? And we're still the over 4,200 Chinese companies that have been basically drawn directly from Chinese domestic exchanges. No regulatory oversight.
These are the so-called A-shares.
A-shares, and that are domiciled in Shenzhen and Shanghai. U.S. index providers go over, load up by the hundreds, bring them back. Investment products of BlackRock, Vanguard, others are built around them in the form of exchange-traded funds and other index funds. And voila, you have scores of millions of Americans unwittingly holding sanctioned U.S. companies, like those on the entity list and elsewhere. You have they have no clue as to how many Chinese companies they're holding. Again, when the numbers are this skewed, I have a count of over 5,300. If you ask the government today, they might say 270. So that's where we sit on that score.
And then, of course, the right number is the larger of those two, as I'm sure it is, based on your analysis, Roger. The numbers that are on these lists is a paltry fraction of that total, is it not? And what does that say to the Chinese about the administration's seriousness of changing course here? And should it say
well, that's put very starkly, Frank, on the disparity that exists between the entity list, which now has about 480 companies on it.
Yeah,
and that number is still solidifying. But because there were nine, there were 36 added this week. And but over at the Chinese military industrial complex companies, which is the capital markets sanctions list run by the Treasury Department, to date, only nine of those companies from the entity list have been precluded from raising capital in big numbers from unwitting American investors. So you can't. So the irony is,
let me just put a fine point on this, Roger, if I may intervene. Chinese military industrial complex companies literally are building the weapon systems designed to kill Americans. And you're telling us that there's a grand total of nine or so that this administration has seen fit to sanction and say, no, you can't get America's investors' money to pay for the weapon systems with which you will, if you have your way, murder Americans? I mean, this is obscene.
It gets a little more dire, Frank, because, you know, since June 3rd, which is, again, when the Biden list started, if I can say that, again, there were no companies added to the list from June 3rd of this year until the last week or so when it went to nine. None of those companies are military companies. All of those nine put on the CMIC cap market sanctions list were human rights violators, and they deserve to be there, and they are egregious offenders, make no mistake. But you notice that the door hasn't been opened to one Chinese military company, because is there not a possible fear on the part of the administration that if they add one Chinese military company, one national security concern company, that does that open the door to the 486 others? And of course, the answer is yes. The number of military companies dwarfs the number of human rights offenders. And these numbers, you know, should be, of course, much, much larger. My goodness, there's 68 companies that have been restricted from raising funds in our markets. It would be scandalous if there were 680. So,
Roger, let me just make one other relevant point here about how we got here. And you've done heroic work exposing this and calling attention to the, well, the implications of it. In May of 2013, somebody helped engineer a deal that not only opened the door to these Chinese companies, but gave them access to our capital markets, stocks and bonds, on preferential terms. Remind us of who that individual was.
Well, this took place during the Obama-Biden administration, and you're quite right, it got down to the public company Accounting Oversight Board, which is the official body of the United States that audits the auditors, remembering Enron and WorldCom, all the disastrous frauds of the early 2000s. We realized that the private auditing companies were often in cahoots because they had a vested financial interest in doing so. So we needed to audit the auditors. Well, every American company is required to do this quite naturally in the course of coming to our markets and listing. But very conveniently, the Chinese are not. And why? Because they didn't want a U.S. government body having the temerity to look into their auditing companies. And so they made quite a stink about it. And we accommodated them by saying, well, we'll get around to that someday. But in the meantime, you just come on in and we won't worry about that auditing business.
And who was the person who helped engineer that, Roger?
Well, the vice president of the United States at the time is the president of the United States today.
His name is Joe Biden. Joe Biden, part of the problem on this portfolio, I think it's fair to say, and remains to be seen whether he's really going to be serious about becoming part of the solution. Roger Robinson, thank you for your time today. Thanks for all the work you do that has brought us to this point where we now at least are fully on notice of the magnitude of this problem, and we need to begin addressing it urgently. It's a part of, I hope, a larger war footing this country adopts vis-a-vis the Chinese and their people's war against us. Keep up the good work, my friend, among other places, at the Prague Security Studies Institute. Come back to us with updates as soon as possible, if you will. Next up, we'll speak with Kyle Scheidler about the enemy within problem. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Winston Churchill described the run-up to World War II as the gathering storm. Today's geostrategic atmospheric conditions suggest that another global conflagration is in the offing in our time. Consider the following indicators of heavy weather inbound. Communist China is building up its forces for attacks on Taiwan and or India. Russia has massed 100,000 troops on its border with Ukraine. Iran's nuclear weapons program could bear fruit at any time, resulting in a devastating attack on or by Israel. North Korea has most of its million-man army poised to invade South Korea. Each of these enemies of freedom actively talk about their intention to exercise these options. And if any of them do so, chances are good that one or more of the others, whether by prearrangement or sheer opportunism, will pile on. Forewarned, better be forearmed. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
A contemporary of Mozart and Haydn, he started losing his hearing at age 28 and eventually became totally deaf. Incredibly, though, he continued writing some of the most beautiful symphonies, concertos, sonatas, and quartets of all time. Today, he ranks as one of the greatest composers in history. His name was Ludwig van Beethoven, and he was born this day, December 17, 1770. Beethoven wrote, "No friend have I must live by myself alone. But I know well that God is nearer to me than others in my art, so I will walk fearlessly with Him."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say one of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, who runs its very important project on homeland security and counterterrorism, is in the house virtually at this moment. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He's no stranger to this program, but we've not talked with him in a while, and there's a lot going on with respect to two sort of categories of what I consider to be the enemies within problem. One is the jihadists, or if you will, Sharia supremacists in our midst. The other is Antifa. We'll talk about them in turn with Kyle. Welcome, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Let me start with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Kyle. Calibrate for us what that organization is, the kind of work it's up to, and what it's up to specifically at the moment with respect to what you've called hate rhetoric.
Well, sure, Frank. So listeners of your program will be no strangers to the Council on American Islamic Relations. They certainly will remember that CAIR was created in 1993 as the media arm for Hamas support networks in the United States, a behavior which they've never abandoned or apologized for. Their leadership under Nihad Awad, their executive director, remains unchanged from the day of their founding. So it's not like they have changed their spots in any way. And they recently had a couple of CAIR leaders, including Nihad Awad, make some statements that reminded us who exactly CAIR is. Nihad Awad was speaking before the American Muslims for Palestine, which is another organization with direct links to Hamas support networks in the United States. But while he was speaking, he made allusions to his claim that Tel Aviv, Israel, was under occupied territory and would one day be liberated. Of course, this obviously implies that all of Israel is illegitimate, all of Israel is occupied territory, because Tel Aviv is not in what we think of as the 67 disputed territories in Judea and Samaria. It's in Israel proper, always has been. So Nihad Awad here is dropping the mask and letting everybody know that CAIR ultimately is pushing for the destruction of Israel.
And when he says that he is praying for it to be freed, is there any way that that can be interpreted, Kyle Scheidler, as other than by force?
Well, I mean, when when you realize that there's no way that you're going to convince the Israelis to abandon the entire Jewish national project and abandon Israel to the Palestinians, then you obviously see very quickly that Nihad Awad means by force. He can only mean by force.
This is an important point of calibration, I think, because the Council on American Islamic Relations has worked with an outfit called the Southern Poverty Law Center to defame the likes of thee and me and lots of other people who have been warning responsibly, accurately, about what CARE, as it's known, and the Muslim Brotherhood, of which, of course, Hamas is the Palestinian franchise, are all about. And for them to be caught out at a moment like this, actually, as you say, escalating their hate rhetoric against Israel, one might say their incitement against Israel, it's particularly telling because they're also generally ramping up their criticism of people who have been thorns in their side, as I'm proud to say, the Center for Security Policy for a long time, and especially with your good work. The Southern Poverty Law Center, of course, is a completely discredited organization. So when
that's one of the things that's so interesting about this dust-up, Frank, is CARE has come under fire from the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which has unfortunately all too often gone along with the sort of SPLC narrative when it comes to people who are critical of the Brotherhood, critical of CARE. But they have gone after CARE in particular because of statements made by CARE San Francisco Representative Zahra Ballou, who called Zionist synagogues in America their enemy. So it is nice to see a little bit of fracturing of those alliances.
Let me ask you, Kyle, about Antifa, another outfit that you have been following closely. In fact, you've written a very important book about, or edited and contributed to, I should say, I guess, a very important book about the unmasking Antifa, as you put it, five perspectives on a growing threat. There seems at long last to be some evidence that somebody in the law enforcement community is doing something about Antifa. Tell us about the district attorney out in San Diego in California, Kyle. This is seemingly a very welcome development.
It is indeed, Frank. It's a very positive development. And the reason why is because that prosecutor is getting to the heart of the question by charging a number of individuals with conspiracy. This has to do with a conflict in which a number of Antifa members attacked a pro-Trump group, and there was a number of assaults and other incidents related to that. And the prosecutor goes in detail in their indictment to describe how Antifa members in Los Angeles and San Diego prearranged for an attack. And this is important because it goes against the narrative that Antifa is simply there to protest and then, you know, sometimes fisticuffs break out. And that's not the case at all. Antifa is a criminal organization that conspires to engage in violence against people in order to violate their civil rights, to violate their ability to speak freely. So the San Diego prosecutor is making that case in court. And it's a real positive because we haven't seen anybody else willing to publicly say what most of us should know, which is that this stuff is being done for a political terrorist purpose, and now they're going to make that case in court. So it's a good day for the good guys.
It is indeed. There's an interesting further angle to this story, which is that the prosecutor, some of these conspiracy cases apparently, has pointed out something that you're not supposed to talk about. I mean, generally, Antifa has gotten a pass writ large, but specifically the role of George Soros in underwriting some of these DAs and prosecutors, and among other positions that he has helped fill across the country, and the contribution that they're making to the lawlessness and even to, I think, the kinds of conspiracies that you're talking about, at least by turning a blind eye to them. So tell us a little bit about the Soros angle in this story, too.
Sure. So recently, the left-wing outlet The Daily Beast went on the offensive against the San Diego prosecutor, whose name is Summer Stephen. And they are not very happy that this prosecutor is going after their Antifa friends. So they did a hit piece on her where they emphasized that she had made statements during the campaign pointing out that George Soros had been funding local prosecutors in order to advance a, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it other than to say a pro-crime agenda, an agenda that is soft on crime. And the Daily Beast is playing this game that people on the left have routinely played when it comes to George Soros, which is to claim that any criticism of Soros, even if it is factually true, and Summer Stevens claimed that George Soros is funding these left-wing DAs is true, but they claim any criticism of Soros is ipso facto anti-Semitic because George Soros has a Jewish background. So they are wading into this fight against the forces of law and order and in defense of Antifa. And it's so important, I think, for your listeners to understand the role that the media plays in protecting and backstopping Antifa violence. Because they are willing to ride to the defense of Antifa, it makes it very hard for us to address the threat that they represent. So this was just a perfect example of the left-wing media in bed with Antifa yet again.
Thank you for calling this out. Thank you for your great work at the Center for Security Policy, Kyle Scheidler, on both the homeland security front and counterterrorism. I don't know of anybody who does it better, and we are very proud of what you do at the center and know you'll keep it up and hope that you will come back to us again with updates on all of this very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a break on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.